You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye, and I'm Al Vona, your host. Nice to have you with us this weekend. There has been a tremendous amount of publicity and the light shed on the legalities, especially as it relates to past presidents, current presidents. It seems like their personal lives have certainly become front and center on most daily newscasts. But behind the scenes, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's George W. Bush, whether it's Joseph Biden, the fact of the matter is that there are powerful law firms representing each and every one of these individuals, hoping to shed light, in the best light, on their clients. And that's why I've invited this week's guest. He's a best-selling author and business investigations editor for the New York Times, David Enrich. His new book is Servants of the Damned, Giant Law Firms, Donald Trump, and the Corruption of Justice. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with David about the book and just how powerful these large law firms are in representing the rich and the famous. And is it unlike what any of us might be able to be entitled to? Hey, David, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to assume that you got kind of the same vibe that you were chomping at the bit here, that these very wealthy, these very powerful people, and I used the term, I said presidents at the outset, but it doesn't have to be a president. You can be a CEO. You can be someone who's inherited vast sums of money. The fact of the matter is that there are powerful law firms working in this country on behalf of those very wealthy, those very powerful people. And I guess the first question would be, and I think most listeners would love to know, was part of the motivation for writing the book the fact that these people have advantages that you or I would never be able to take advantage of?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation. And the one part I would quibble with is that it's less about people than it is about corporations. And today's modern law firm is really doing the vast, overwhelming majority of its work is not on behalf of even rich and famous people. It's on behalf of rich, powerful, multinational corporations that are seeking any advantage they can get as they compete against each other, as they try to wriggle out of government oversight and try to avoid taxes, and as they try to shield themselves from normal human beings who have been harmed by the products they're selling. And so the work that these law firms are doing is not only not available to you or me or presumably most of your listeners, but it's really, it completely distorts and skews the playing field on which we are supposed to operate when we're trying to get justice for ourselves or even just a fair outcome when it comes to the power the government has to regulate a powerful industry. So it is, yeah, that is why I wrote the book. And I think it's really important for more people to understand the way these law firms operate and the impact that it has on our society, our economy, and even our democracy.
David, I'm going to, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I'm going to assume that, one, in order to even contract any of these powerful law firms, as you talked about, you have to be very wealthy. But some people would say, well, what possibly could be at stake that would warrant someone having to be billed for thousands of dollars an hour, for hours on end per week, maybe for years. So at the end of the line, the bill for their services, for services rendered, could easily be in the millions. I guess it would be fair to say that there's going to be a whole lot more at stake than what they're spending, right?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the bill that a law firm will charge a big company for just 1 year's worth of work is well over $100 million. So it's huge sums of money. And I think you're right. That is an indication of the tremendously high stakes these companies and occasionally these individuals are facing, that they feel that it's worth $100 million. To pay a law firm to defend them. And, it ranges from a tax dispute they might be having with the IRS over a couple billion dollars. That's clearly worth spending $100 billion if you might be able to save a couple billion. It's, to me, the more interesting area is comes down to when a big company is accused of selling a product that ends up, when it's used properly, harming the customer. So, and I focus a bunch on the series of cases involving powdered infant formula, which is made by companies including Abbott Laboratories. And, you know, there's a pattern going back decades of companies that's, or of people who consume this powdered formula. So babies, on rare occasions, they contract a type of meningitis that either kills them or leaves them severely brain damaged. And so there's a whole slew of lawsuits that have been filed by the families of babies who have been harmed. And for Abbott, this is a multi-billion dollar issue, right? I mean, if they have to pay up to all these families who have been harmed, that's a lot of money. But B, and I think more important, they're really concerned that if the powdered infant formula they're selling is exposed to the public as a real potential health risk, that severely harms Abbott's ability to sell this stuff. And so, Abbott is a classic example of the type of corporate client that a law firm, in this case Jones Day, which is a big law firm founded in Cleveland 100 years ago, that they will just spend whatever it takes to defeat plaintiffs whose kids have been harmed and to fend off government oversight. So that to me is a really kind of powerful example of one example of the type of work that these law firms are doing that is worth probably every penny that Abbott is paying them.
Yeah, as you said, they've got a reputation to uphold. Any new products coming forth would certainly be tainted by that. So clearing their name early on allows them to continue business. You talked about Jones Day. After reading the book, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but one of the law firms that, and this is the one that I think most people, this issue, can relate to, and that's the tobacco industry. I know growing up in the 50s and 60s, you know, smoking cigarettes was glorified, even on television commercials, billboards, you name it. And then when health experts uncovered the fact that, cancers of all types and addiction, blah, 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 there was a lot at stake here. But it was Jones Day, right? It was one of those law firms that represented big tobacco. Most people, you don't see them walking down the street with a cigarette hanging out of their mouth, but they still sell tobacco, David. So my sense is that they didn't maybe win the overall battle, but they certainly kept these businesses afloat, right?
Yeah, and Jones Day started representing RJR, which makes Camel cigarettes, among other things, in the mid-1980s. And that was a time, as you just alluded to, where it had become just indisputably clear, based on reams and reams of scientific evidence, that cigarettes were not only really harmful to your health, but they were also addictive. And that was something that contradicted many years of the tobacco industry's insistences that there's just the scientific verdict was out. And so Jones Day took on this assignment and immediately became essentially a public spokesman for the tobacco industry, and in that capacity started spreading the same kind of misinformation about the science behind this, and really started trying to cloud and the science and muddy the waters and say that it just really was not clear that tobacco was, or that nicotine was addictive. And one of their top lawyers kept saying things the effect of, if nicotine is addictive, by the same standard, so is chocolate, so is jogging. Things that especially viewed 40 years later just seem a lot like lies. But you're right, they have been, Jones Day, along with a couple of other mostly smaller law firms, has been extremely effective at mitigating the damage that regulations and litigation could have done to the tobacco industry. And you're right that cigarette smoking has gone down tremendously in the past 40 or 50 years. There's no doubt about that. But it's also true that a surprisingly large number of young people, like high school students, for example, are still sampling and in some cases using and getting addicted to tobacco or nicotine-based products. And that is in part because of the vaping market has kind of come out of thin air in the past several years. But I think it's also a fact that law firms like Jones Day have been extremely effective, including in places like Massachusetts, at whenever there is a threat, even on a local level, to impose a certain type of regulation or restriction on the sale or use of tobacco products, Jones Day swoops in with lots of lawyers and very fancy letterhead, and it scares these towns often into submission. And I detail in the book one example in a town, Marion, Massachusetts, which is right off Buzzards Bay,
right,
where this exact scenario played out. And Jones Day was kind of using very weak legal arguments, according to the experts I've spoken with. But still, because they were such a big law firm, and because their client was so big, and because of the threats of litigation that they were using were so scary, it worked. And the town dropped its plans to impose restrictions on the sale of flavored tobacco. And so, scenarios like that have been playing out all over the country for a very long time. And I think it is probably safe to say that were it not for this type of kind of smash-mouth legal defense that law firms like Jones Day are deploying, there would probably be fewer people today smoking tobacco or nicotine-based products, and therefore fewer people dying from using those products.
And as you alluded to, you know, small municipalities who had, you know, who had the who had the evidence to support many of the findings and take some action, realized early on that you know, they were going to use up all their revenue, all their capital, in trying to fight a big law firm, and that just wasn't going to work, and they ended up bailing out. I just want to take a quick pause and remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest this week is best-selling author David Enrich. His new book is Servants of the Damned, and we're talking about the incredible power and influence that giant law firms have, whether they be representing top-notch companies, Fortune 500 companies, or even powerful political figures, you know, here in this country, from coast to coast, and why the rich and famous always seem to get off on many things that most everyday people would not be able to get away with. And David, that comes down to the, you know, after reading the book, you can't help but harbor a little resentment in thinking that, you know, if I had $100 million stashed away, and you know, I wanted to, and I were in the same kind of boat, I wouldn't have as much to fear, because I could hire a Jones Day and protect my interest. But for everyday people like you or I, you know, even if it seems minimal, you know, minuscule, we'd have the book thrown at us. You have to basically give away everything you own just to be able to retain a law firm. So it really, I guess what I'm trying to say is, your book points out the major difference, and this is nothing new. This has been going on for decades, the haves and the have-nots, right?
Yeah, it's a completely skewed playing field. And to me, one of the things that I have kind of come to understand as I reported and wrote the book is that when you go to a big law firm like Jones Day as a reporter and say, I'm working on a story or a book about you doing these kind of sketchy tactics in representing this kind of sketchy company, they almost always come back with the same response or some version of it, which is that that's what lawyers do. We take on the worst clients and offer them a legal defense, a robust legal defense, because the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution says that everyone is entitled to a robust legal defense. And in fact, our justice system depends on this. We have an adversarial justice system where it's predicated on having two opposing sides well represented by zealous legal counsel basically fighting against each other. And you have dispassionate judges and juries sitting in the middle, and their job is to kind of filter out the truth and decide on the just outcome. And, you know, I've heard that argument trotted out myself many times, and just as I've been going around talking to people about my book in the past couple months, there is you know, I can't tell you the number of people, just lay people, who have kind of cited a similar version of that argument. And there's a really big problem with that argument in this case, though, which is that this adversarial justice system that is such a kind of a bedrock of the American legal system and American democracy, really, it is based on the idea that there will be some equilibrium between the two sides that are fighting in court. And so if you have two big companies going after each other in court, the argument really, it holds up very well, because both sides have enough money and time and resources to hire the biggest, baddest law firms, and they can just go to war in court and leave it to the judge and jury to figure out the truth. It does not work well, though, when you have on one side a family and their small-time lawyer who have been seriously harmed by, I'm just making this up, but cigarettes or baby formula or a defective airbag or something like that. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you have a law firm like Jones Day that has something like 2,500 lawyers and 40 offices around the world and billions of dollars in revenue. And behind them, a client that has, for all intents and purposes, unlimited resources to throw at a problem. That does not create a fair fight in court. And it means that this adversarial justice system that we're also fond of talking about, and is, again, such an important part of our justice system, it really doesn't work if one side has, you know, a thousand times the resources of the other side.
No, it's night and day. In completing the book, I'm sure you had many times, and going from chapter to chapter and looking at case by case. But when it was all said and done, is there one particular company, is there one particular issue or case that was just so blatant that really was revolting? In as you would, you know, I know you alluded to the fact that, you know, the haves and the haves not totally different in terms of the kind of legal representation that they can afford to and realistically afford to hire. But is there one really blatant case that really stuck out for you?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple. And I think the clearest one to me is one I've already kind of talked about a little bit, which is the one involving Abbott Labs and the powdered infant formula. Mm-hmm. So I focus in that chapter of the book on a family out in Sioux City, Iowa, whose daughter, when she was, I think, 12 days old, was given powdered formula and contracted this type of bacterial meningitis that is historically linked to powdered formula and nearly died, but survived, but with brain damage so severe that she cannot talk or walk or even sit up in bed or swallow food on her own. And that's going to be her life. And the family is a poor family that is facing, you know, probably millions of dollars in medical expenses over the girl Janine's lifetime. And, you know, there's the Iowa's version of Medicaid and things like that that are providing some support, but they are just in this impossible situation. And so they hired a lawyer at a small firm because that was what they could afford, and that was who they had connections with. And he sued Abbott, and this is one of a number of suits that Abbott faced where Jones Day was representing them. And Jones Day's response to the lawsuit was, and in court they argued that there was no proof of where this fateful bacteria came from. Maybe it was the mom's fault, maybe it was the dad's fault, who knows, maybe it was the dog's fault, the family dog's fault. But I think more alarming than that was that the tactics that Jones Day used, both in court and out of court before the trial, were what a federal judge who was presiding over the case described as just completely beyond the pale. And they were engaging in all sorts of kind of trickery and intimidation is maybe too strong a word, but kind of in that direction, according to the federal judge. And the result was that not only did the jury kind of get this muddled message about the pretty clear science behind the risks of powdered infant formula, you know, there's not many places. A baby is only consuming one thing, usually. It's not like a baby is crawling around on the floor at 12 days, like licking up dirt that might have bacteria in it. They're consuming what is fed to them, either from the breast or from a bottle.
Right.
And in this case, the only thing the baby was consuming was the powdered infant formula, which has a track record, scientifically proven, of being a breeding ground for the exact type of bacteria that causes this type of meningitis and can be deadly. And, you know, so Jones Day is very adept at A, muddying the science, which is a tactic they picked up while they were representing Big Tobacco, and B, just really creating inconsistencies in witnesses' testimony, making it very hard for the opposing lawyers, the plaintiff's lawyers, to even conduct a reasonable deposition of Abbott employees. And again, what stands out about this case is not the particulars of the victim or the imbalance, because that's totally normal in these cases. What stands out is that in this case, they actually got pretty severely chastised by the federal judge presiding over the case, who is a longtime, well-regarded federal judge, who said that the conduct that he witnessed with these Jones Day lawyers in this case was the worst he had ever seen as a judge. And so and by the way, the coda to this story, without giving too much away, is that the judge tries to punish these lawyers for their, what he's described as, abusive conduct in the case, and ends up getting foiled in the end because Jones Day very successfully makes an appeal to a higher court on technical grounds that leads to the invalidation of the penalty he imposed. And the message to me is that not only is there a really imbalanced system of justice, but there's also no accountability often for lawyers who are not quite violating the rules or kind of but walking right up to the line.
Yeah.
But in some cases, probably stepping over. And it sends a message to everyone who's paying attention, including lawyers at other firms, that you can kind of get away with pushing the envelope pretty badly.
Right. And the part, David, and you mentioned it right from the beginning, was the fact that an innocent child it has been debilitated for the rest of her or his life, and nobody, those days in court, you remember that for a while, but everything else, you go on with your life, and the family is responsible, and the family has to deal with that burden, and that's the saddest part, and you can't help but get angry. And the book wasn't written with the intent of causing people to get so angry that they'd be waiting outside their lawyer's office to chastise him or her. The fact of the matter is that this was very eye-opening, and I'm glad that you wrote it, because I think everybody, I don't care where you are on the economic scale or socioeconomic scale, whatever it may be, the fact of the matter is that it's not an even or level playing field, and the cases that you brought out in the book certainly point that. We've only got a couple of moments left with all of this. That are you by chance hopeful? Because it would really mean something that Congress, I would think, an act of Congress to correct some of the procedures within the legal framework in this country. Is that likely anytime soon?
No. Like, zero likelihood, I would say. I mean, to me, one of the reasons I wrote this book, I mean, there are a bunch, but one of them is that, to me, for there to be change in the legal profession, it needs to occur. It's not going to occur at these big corporate law firms. It needs to occur, at least in part, at the law school level, where you have, this kind of toxic stew of factors leading people to go down this employment path. And then one of the factors is the amount of debt that law students have to take on to get through law school, which leaves them, many of them, in a huge financial hole, and it makes it very enticing to go work at a big law firm that's going to pay you right out of the gates well into the six figures.
Yeah.
And another issue is that the professors at law schools often are they recognize the career trajectory of many of their students, and they're kind of just accepted that and are embracing a vision of the law and of lawyers that is just wholly consistent with the big law firm view of the world. And instead of really, I think, in many cases, challenging their students to think about what they could do with their lives and with their careers. And I think the other thing is that a lot of these law schools have just very cozy relationships with a lot of these big corporate law firms, where they invite them onto campus to recruit their students. And the law schools have a financial incentive to have their students getting as rich as possible, as quickly as possible, because that increases the odds that the students will make donations to the law school, and it allows the law schools to go around as they recruit new students to say, we have this percentage of our students going into jobs that are paying them a boatload of money. Yeah. And so I think it's, to me, that's where the change needs to take place. And it's not completely implausible that that change could happen, because there are a lot of very idealistic and well-intentioned students and faculties and administrators at many of the country's leading law schools.
Well, I've said it before, David, crime does pay. For some people, that is. real quick, people want to pose questions to you directly, just find out more about your research and the things that you've been working on. I know, obviously, the book is widely available, Servants of the Dam, but if they wanted to just pose questions to you or just find out more about your background, how might they do that?
Social media is the easiest way. You can find my email address on most of my social media accounts. Twitter is David Enrich, E-N-R-I-C-H, all one word. Instagram is David.Enrich. Facebook is David J. Enrich. So find me. I'd love to hear from people.
There's the invitation. Again, I want to thank David Enrich for writing the book, Servants of the Dam, Giant Law Firms, Donald Trump, and the Corruption of Justice. A really stark reminder that there are two different worlds, one for the haves and then the have-nots, and there's still that divide that continues to plague not only here in this country but across the globe, obviously. But those who have the means certainly are always in a better position to defend any issue or anything that comes their way. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.